and how to make it work better. And one of the most frequently discussed subjects is antennas. Is antennas. Because it's a subject not well enough covered in the schools, in my opinion. It's a subject that's not super easy to understand the first time you hear it. So we discuss a lot of antennas and standing wave ratio and feed lines, as well as transmitters, receivers, and propagation, and the 26 or so different kinds of ham radio, and there's quite a few more being added these days now that more elaborate digital techniques are taking place. TMR is just one of those. Let me drop. The very loose schedule that we use for the TechNet consists of approximately the first hour, not necessarily, depending on enthusiasm, the first hour can become longer or shorter. Quite often it becomes longer if we get onto a good hot subject that everybody's got a lot of opinions on. So we take questions of a general nature. People sign in with their call letters and their name, and they give us their question or comment. That's followed by John, KC2WJB, who handles the mailbag and also monitors the website for EchoLink. So if you have trouble signing in because we don't give the right amount of time, people get excited and don't listen to the four beeps between transmissions, and people don't get an itch in word-wise, well, by way of that website, John knows about it, and you can send him messages. He also collects the questions and comments from the people who don't yet have the right equipment to talk to us directly, or don't have the right equipment to don't have the ham license yet. Let me drop. That's followed by Paul, WS2N, our space expert, and there's always something new going on in space. So he brings us up on the latest in that. So that's the loose schedule. And this goes on for almost 4 hours every single Sunday night. We start at 8, usually don't stop before midnight. And for the people who can't stay up that long and whenever we're able to hear what goes on, there are two very beautiful websites, we call them, by Mike 1 and Mike 2. Mike 1 is the website of www.amateurradio.tangovictor. You go there a few days after the TechNet, like Wednesday or Thursday, and that particular week's where the TechNet's audio will be recorded. The last 10 years worth of TechNet are recorded there. So you choose the right year, the right month, the right week, the right hour of the four hours of the four reels, each reel, so to speak, that you can download is 1 hour's worth of audio. And there are people who download that onto their various portable devices by which they can then listen to it at a more convenient time while driving to work, while sitting on the train, or at noon hour, and so on. So we've got some fans that like TechNet well enough that they're willing to do it that way. They can't stay up until midnight because they got to go to work the next day. The real working people, John and I, are not real working people. We're independently private citizens these days. Isn't that true, John? KC2WGB for any comment on that. K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Very true, Dick. I think I'm busier now than I was when I was working. I think you're basically in the same thing. Have so many things to do. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, we're so busy being retired that we don't have time for work anymore. It tends to fill up the day. So, that gives you a loose schedule. What you're about to hear is TechNet number 1,583, if I get the numbers right, yeah, 1,583 of the series that began 33 years and 2 months ago. September of 1982 is when the TechNet began. And me and Hip, N2FDJ at that time, thought that this is something that would last for a couple of weeks. We'd answer everybody's questions. We'd dry up and go away. Well, there's always a lot more to learn about wireless equipment. There's a lot more people, always new people joining the hobby. It's now at an all-time high. I forget the exact numbers. I think it's, was it something like 600,000 amateur radio operators in the United States, or was it 700,000? Is that the right number, John, if you remember?
Yes, Dick, it's over 700,000 from what I understand, and rising along with the than CW operators, which is amazing.
Who would ever believe that when the United States joined the rest of the world, where their ham radio license no longer required proving your competence with Morse code, and now because it's such an interesting art form, it's something that's no longer required, and it's now becoming more popular. There are people I know who go to sleep listening to Morse code. You know, they play it in their tape recorder on their pillow, so to speak, as a way of going to sleep. I'm trying to think of what's the name of the guy who used to do that?
Mel.
Mel, N2KUI. He used to go to sleep that way. But he's now become a silent key, unfortunately. Okay. Guess we're ready to roll. You're going to sign in by giving me your call letters, your name, because I'm so forgetful. I like referring people by name. Not just a number. And then the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. You need not sign in just because you're listening. After 33 years of running the TechNet, we believe somebody is listening. In total number of hours of service and total number of years of existence, we think the TechNet is coming very close to a record, if it's not a record, on various kinds of longevity. So, call letters, name, and the word yes. Give me your call letters.
Number 2 Echo Oscar, Rich, and yes.
Oh, I see what's going on here. Okay, so we got Rich signing in, N2EO. Anyone else? Give me your call letters right now, K2RIW.
Looking for like mid to the center of the country. acquired the Octagon. Also, what do I do to deal with the village in Massapequa? I called the building department some time ago. They didn't know what ham radio was. They never heard of it. Back to net and Tweeo.
Understand, Rich. And Tweeo, KQLAW in the TechNet.
Case for a weather station, Dick.
Okay, I think you said there's another station we should pick up. Who is the other station?
No, Dick, I was saying it's a good situation for him to claim a weather station.
Yeah, we've, I guess it was Dennis, among other people, who were suggesting that if you call your antenna a weather station and really put some kind of weather station equipment on it when you're erecting, let's say, a vertical in the backyard, to call the weather station is a hell of a lot friendlier to, say, a zoning board or to neighbors than to call it an antenna, particularly something that radiates RF energy, radio frequency energy, radio frequency radiation. It radiates. Those are motion sounding words. In the case of a quarter wave ground plane antenna, because a dipole is what you really want to transmit if this is the best of all worlds, and a dipole is really a pair of monopoles back to back. You can put a sheet of metal between the two halves of a dipole at right angles to it. It would have no change on the gain, no change on the impedance, no change on the performance. And once you realize that, you can throw away one half of the dipole and just use the dipole, the other half, with that sheet of metal. We call that a ground plane antenna. So a quarter wave radiator, in order to work correctly, needs that great big sheet of metal. There's nothing magic about making sure that your radiator is a quarter wavelength long. You can electronically make it a half wavelength long. Let me drop. In other words, by putting loading coils, zigzags, helical winding, there's all kinds of, and top hat capacitors, there's all kinds of ways that you can make the radiator electronically a half wavelength long, even though physically it may only be a little bit longer than a quarter wave. If the resonator, the radiator, is electronically a half wave, and if you're feeding the outer end of it, because there's nothing magic about feeding the center of a dipole, you can feed it the halfway between center and outside edge, or all the way up the outside edge. The only disadvantage of feeding the outside edge is you're feeding a 1,500 ohm impedance instead of a 70 ohm impedance. But it's a very simple L network, as an example, impedance matching network that takes your 50 ohm cable from your transmitter and steps it up to 1,500 ohms to feed the outer edge. Once you're feeding the outer edge of a radiator, because it is a half wave radiator instead of a quarter wave radiator, you almost require no ground plane radials at all. See, the quarter wave radiator, when you're feeding the middle of it, it's half of 73 ohms, let's call it 36 ohms. When you're feeding 36 ohm antenna, a quarter wave radiator, to really do it efficiently, you'd need some large number of ground plane radials. And in your particular case, I've seen your house laying down. In your particular case, laying down all those ground plane radials on your particular piece of land would be rather difficult. As long as you make sure that that radiator is a half wave electronic radiator, half wave electronic radiator, you no longer need any ground plane radios at all. One simple ground rod is more than good enough. The guys who operate a portable, like at they do it that way. Now, in your particular case, you want to be able to receive better. You want to be able to transmit better. That implies you want a hell of a lot more antennas in the air. That quarter wave ground plane radiator vertical thing that we're talking about, as opposed to the current dipole you've got, yes, it's cross-polarized. That's going to give you a slight advantage. You've also talked about putting up Yagi-like things, a rotating dipole or rotating two-element Yagi. Those things are going to give you a couple couple of dB of gain over where you are right now, probably 4 dB at best, whereas that's that high-power amplifier you're about to put on for 15 watts peak and envelope power, that's going to give you a 12 decibel advantage in signal strength when transmitting. And if you do put up another dipole, you got one dipole now at running east-west, so to speak, and if you put another one on north-south, that's going to give you a hell of a lot more coverage than you've got right now. So that amplifier is going to give you a lot more bang for the money than some of these antenna combinations you're talking about, putting towers on the roof of the house and ground planes in the backyard. I'm not saying don't do it. I'm just saying you can get more bang for the dollar out of the amplifier and another dipole at right angles to the one you've got. That's an opinion on my part. Maybe other people have got some opinions on this too, Rich. N2EO, KQLIW in the Tech Net.
Okay, Dick, thank you. N2EO. You know, a couple of guys on 7255, ILIKE.net, EastGuard, East Coast Amateur Radio Service. By the way, anybody interested can go to EastGuard, ECARS, 7255. com, and if anybody needs a pill, I'll give it to them again. There's two people on there using NFED tuned quarter wave long wires, and just what you say, the matching them. That would maybe be good for me, because then I don't have to impose on my neighbor. What do you think, Dick?
Are you saying that you do hear East Cars well enough, Rich? I know from time to time you talk about not having good enough reception. In some cases, what you think is not good enough reception is they're not hearing you over all the noise. And once you become two S units stronger because of that amplifier, they're going to hear you. Out of curiosity, I think you're able to sign into East Cars almost any time you want to. Is that true, Rich? N2EO, K2LIW.
That's correct. Net control, they run shifts about 1 or 2 hours, and another one takes over. They hear me fine, because they're well set up. I assume up and down the East Coast, the guys in Pennsylvania, I have a pipeline. They hear me, I hear them. Once I get to Florida, the week, both transit and scene, there's a fellow on in New Hampshire. I don't hear him well, and he doesn't hear me well, so I don't know. Back to that.
An awful lot of how well you hear each other is a function of you putting out enough steam, as I see it. And the 100 watts you run right now is going to become a hell of a lot stronger signal when you have that high-power amplifier ready to roll. I know you've got a little bit of a problem right now with getting the 240-volt line wired to the ham shack, but I think Barry's about to visit you on that one to find out how easy it's going to be to establish that cable. And there's a lot of different ways of doing that, even if it works that the room where you want to do it is a slab where there isn't a real basement underneath for an easy installation. There's all kinds of ways around that. So, as I see it, your life's going to become a lot nicer when you can radiate a little bit more power. I wonder if there's another question along these lines you've got, Rich. N2EO, K2LIW in the Tech Net.
Oh, Dick, I'm not going to belabor the point. Yes. Has an electrician in here. I'm getting two more quotes. He said because of slab, he can't get in there with a snake. He has one electrical conduit, you know, PVC outside the house, and come in around the wall. He wants a little over $1,000. I didn't expect that, so that's the wait. But anyway, that's another problem. Anyway, I wouldn't ask Barry to do it. I want a licensed electrician, so there's no problems down the road. And what can I tell you? Anyway, look, I want to wish everybody, all
joins it, rarely do they give it up. Oh, they give it up temporarily for short periods of time when certain complicated things are going on in their life. But even if you get disappointed with the kind of ham radio you're using, because there's 26 or so different kinds of ham radio, before giving up this very educational hobby, try one of the other 25 kinds. Next person is Dennis, NY2H, out there on the North Fork of Long Island. He's one of those very few people that has his own independent power, almost. He doesn't have quite the ability to go completely off the grid, so to speak. But he's one of those very green guys who is using independent power reception techniques, mostly solar voltaic. I think he's in the talking phase of considering a windmill. So what's the latest out there with you, Dennis? NY2H, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Thank you, Dick. It's NY2HF. The question I have for the net tonight is, what's the most memorable question you've ever been asked? And this goes out to Dick and John. What's the most memorable question you've ever been asked while you've been on the net, which is probably a very long time? And Dick, as far as my capabilities out here, I'm actually well beyond what I said before. But that's for another net. I'm really curious. What's the most interesting question you've ever been asked? Back to net.
I'm probably going to have to think about that one for a while, Dennis. NY2H, K2RW in the TechNet. Most memorable or most exciting, most unusual. Oh, occasionally we get questions on things pretty far adrift from ham radio. Just to give you one crazy example, I get a huge amount of response from people when we discuss oil burners, oil burner service. We amateurs, at least a good percentage of us, higher than the regular population, are willing to do our own equipment repair. Most of us will open up the case of that transmitter, that receiver, and start doing a troubleshooting if it gives us any grief. We don't worry about violating the warranty because you've broken the seal and opened up the case. And some of those same people no longer have the opinion that the majority of the population does. There's something that there's rocket science involved with their furnace of their house, and they were unwilling to touch it. So we discuss oil burner from time to time, about once every year, maybe twice a year. We get on the subject of oil burner maintenance, and even sometimes gas furnace maintenance. Boy, do we get a lot of responses on that one. Wow. I mean, all kinds of mail where people were saying, hey, I missed some of that information. Where can I play that back? Where can I get the names of the equipment, the names of the suppliers, the techniques for doing that maintenance? The furnace in your house is not rocket science. It's a hell of a lot simpler in some respects than the refrigerator, if you know what I mean. And I've done some refrigerator repair. My house also has a central air that I installed. And back in the days when you can buy that equipment directly from Sears Roebuck, you can save yourself a small fortune.
Repeater, timeout.
In the case of air conditioner, where I've got has central air conditioning, where my house has a warm air heating system, in other words, call it hot air. I don't have baseboard radiation, so I've got ductwork that feeds the hot air / warm air around the house. And I install the central air conditioning in such a way that it feeds the air conditioning air into the hot air ducts. And there's all kinds of articles and people's opinions saying that you can't do that. You're going to get striated air where the bottom of each room is going to be cold air, and the top of each room is going to be hot air. If you do that, that you have to have completely independent ducts to run the air conditioning. 99% of the world says that. I ignored those words, and I installed the air conditioning in such a way that it feeds the hot air ducts. Works like a charm. What we don't realize is that you think the main thing the air conditioning is doing is cooling the air in your house on a hot day. Not necessarily. The main thing it's doing is removing the moisture. It's the high humidity that makes you feel uncomfortable. Let me drop. be too high in humidity. So, as I said, I've installed the central air that way 20-some-odd years ago, and works like a charm. Does a beautiful job in the summertime with not a second set of the ducts. In my case, to put in that second set of air conditioning ducts would have been a pretty serious installation. Let's see, John, of all the questions you've gotten by way of the mailbag and that you and I have handled on the TechNet, from your point of view, what's the most exciting, most unusual? To answer Dennis's question, what subject would you choose as to the ones that are noteworthy on the TechNet? KC2WGB, K2LIW on the TechNet.
1YDY with a comment.
KC2WGB, very good, Dick. I think I would have to say the one I got the most mail on and the most response was that simple question about the electron having weight and the effects on the electron, if you remember that one. That we covered almost three nets on that subject off and on. So I think that was the one with the most reaction. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, we have on a few occasions gotten into some pretty deep, very basic, call it physics, atomic research, whatever. So how heavy are those electrons? And when it comes to explaining antenna theory, I've got a couple of puzzles I've come up with in which you discuss the flow of the electrons down the transmission line and into the antenna on the assumption that your eye could see them or your equipment could see them. You're slowing them down in time and you can actually visualize them. So I've come up with a few puzzles along those lines. Let's see what Hank wants to add to all this. N1YDY, K2LAW. Go ahead, Hank.
Good evening, gentlemen, and Dick in particular. Yeah, I just wanted to comment on the air conditioning and the ductwork. The company that I used to work for at one point allowed a salesman to sell them an oversized air conditioner for a building that they were going to use for a training center in Florida, in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And the bottom line was is that the unit had so much capacity that it cooled the air before it drained the moisture out, which we have since learned is called ring out.
Now, what I think you're saying, Hank, is there's a definite disadvantage. There's a definite disadvantage. Conditioner. But using an air conditioner that is undersized or too far oversized. So, that's the disadvantage in doing that. However, there are ways of most of these machines these days, you could run them on a part-time basis with the right kind of a timing mechanism. So I suspect that if you had a machine that is oversized and you ran it for rather brief periods of time, I suspect there's ways you can get around this undersizing or oversizing. What do you think, Hank? And when YDY, K2LIW on the TechNet?
Antenna trouble here. I'm going to sign.
WS2N.
Okay, we're going to go to Paul and John in that order. Go ahead, Paul.
I know that's a common problem. Let's say somebody wants to buy a window air conditioner or a wall air conditioner, and they'll have a certain size room, either a bedroom or a small, you know, another small room. And what happens is they don't take the time to take the measurements of their room, and they'll just go out and buy the biggest one that'll fit in that window. And the same kind of thing happens. It cools down too quick, and then the moisture in the air never gets a chance to condense on the evaporator. And the next thing you know, you have a very damp room. That's what happens. You wind up with a dampness in the room. So that's the problem. Buying an oversized deck. When you're 15 by 20, whatever it is, and then you have a basic chart that you could use to let you know, should I get an 8,000 BTU, a 3,000, a 5,000, a 12,000, back you there.
I wonder, Paul, if something else could be going on there. Because if an air conditioner is working correctly, the evaporator coil that's in the air conditioner, the thing that gets cold, if it really does get cold and the air is running past it, the air has no choice but to condense some of the moisture out of the air right at that point. So if the cold coils in your air conditioner, whether it be a window type or a household type, in either case, those coils running cold are going to be taking moisture out of the air. What's wrong with that? With that thinking from your point of view, Paul? WS2N K2LIW.
It would have to do with the volume, the amount of air that passes that coil, and it needs to go past a couple of times before you remove the proper amount of moisture, not just once. So the next thing you know, you have a cool room. All the moisture, the amount of moisture that you want to remove has not been removed yet, and you could wind up with to the point where you could be touching the walls and you could feel dampness to it. Starting to condensate in the room. Back to you there.
I'm going to let the machine fully. We'll pick up Dennis in a minute after John. I'm going to let the machine fully reset. Stand by.
Come in.
Yeah, I think we've lost the eastern input. The 147.375 machine is not operating right now, unfortunately. So maybe Eric KE2EJ, if he's available, can do that reset. Or maybe somebody else can do that reset. John is the next person on our list of people to make comment on all this. But if the fan is running slow enough in that window air conditioner, if it has enough BTU capacity to make its cooling coils cold enough, and if the fan is running slow enough, you don't have a super fast fan, I predict that the air only has to go through those coils once to remove the moisture of that portion of the air that goes through those coils. So you feel that the air has to go through the coils multiple times to remove the moisture. I'm having trouble with that one, but we'll soon find out. John, KC2WGB, you want to make comment on all of the above? Go right ahead. K2RIW in the TechNet.
KD2HUC with a comment.
WGB. Yes. As you know and I know, Dick, we've been out to Arizona many times, and there's a classic example. You'd be out in the daytime, you're in the sun, it's 110 degrees, it's warm. But as soon as you go into the shade, because of that dry air, your perspiration is evaporating at a great rate, and you feel much cooler. You do not realize that temperature. And what Paul is saying is correct. If the room temperature is satisfied too quickly, because as higher you go up in BTUs, you do have a higher fan velocity. Yes, if you lowered the fan velocity and made it slower, you wouldn't get that rate of exchange, but it would dehumidify, because the dehumidification process needs a long time in running for it to do its job. So if you satisfy the room temperature too quick, especially in the local area, the unit will shut down and you will not remove moisture. It takes many trips through that air conditioner. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
And to RDB, comment.
82HUC with a comment.
Hey, HUC with a comment is right after Dennis came up first. NY2HF, you want to make comments on all this? Go right ahead, Dennis. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thank you, Dick. NY2HF, I just wanted to say that it's a shame that everything that's being said because of interference. I know we shouldn't say that on our channel frequency, but it's really a shame because guys have got a lot to contribute. It's unfortunate that we can't hear everything that you say. Back to Ned.
Yeah, if you guys are hearing things you think shouldn't be there, please report it to Limelock. In other words, go to the reverse mode on your rig where you listen to the input and record what signal strength you heard on the input and at what time you heard it, and go to ARRL.org, and there's a website, there is a section of the ARRL website where you can record what you've heard, and that information is something very helpful to the effort they're going through right now to eliminate.
Mark.org, not ARRL.
What was that again? Is it ARRL? It's Limelock.org is what I thought it was. Is that true?
Limelock.org. Limelock.org, you'll find a place where you can enter the signals that you hear.
Okay, I might have said it backwards, ARRL. It's Limelock, LIMARC.org. So anything you hear on the input that you think shouldn't be there, please report it to Limelock.org. Go there and find the right place where you fill in the application, so to speak. And that information, they're gathering lots of it over a period of time, and that would be very helpful. So you do want to record how strong was the signal, what did you hear, and what time did you hear it. Okay, Steve was the next person who wanted to make comment on all of the above. Mr. HUC, go right ahead, K2RW in the tech net.
Yeah, Dick, I heard the comment that you made about if the fan was going slow enough through the coil that it would be able to remove the humidity. The only problem with that is that most room air conditioners lack a lot of sophisticated control, and the airflow, the amount of heat that the evaporator absorbs is carefully calculated. If the fan is not moving fast enough and the evaporator is not absorbing enough heat, then the liquid doesn't boil, the liquid refrigerant won't boil fast enough. And what will happen is the pressure in the evaporator will dump below the freezing point of water. And that's what will actually cause the evaporator to freeze up on you. So if you oversize the unit, even though slowing down the fan would in theory make it, you know, allow it to make up a little bit of the difference, you'd end up freezing the coil solid and then you wouldn't get anything cold other than a block of ice. Back to you, KD2HUC.
And to RDB, comment.
RDB recognized, and you brought up a very good point, Steve, and I've had that happen when the whole system is not sized correctly and the coils run too cold, and so therefore the moisture that's being removed from the air is not coming out in liquid form, but it's actually freezing to the coils. You eventually make your cold coils on your air conditioner one solid block of ice, and if you don't know that, it can run in that mode for a long period of time and giving you no benefit. By turning it off for the right period of time to melt that water and start all over again, melt that ice and start all over again, makes things work a lot better. There's lots of ways that an air conditioner cannot work correctly if the air filter is clogged, so the airflow is not sufficient. If you're not cleaning that often enough, terrible things can happen. But still, a rather minor amount of maintenance under normal circumstances is required to maintain a window or a central air type air conditioner, in my opinion. And we amateurs have got enough smarts to be able to do that, in my opinion. N2RDB, start off with your name, I should know you, with your comment, K2RIW in TechNet. Go right ahead, sir.
Thank you, Dick. This is Tim, N2RDB. I heard the conversation about air conditioners and such. I have found through personal experience the best way to have an oversized room air conditioner and you want it to remove the humidity air, fan speed on high as it goes. Don't obsess over the fan speed. But what you do is you figure out what the ambient temperature is. Most air conditioners will give you some indication of that, at least most of the modern ones. If not, use the old-fashioned method with a thermometer. And you set your thermostat about 3 degrees, just 1 or 2 degrees below whatever the ambient room temperature is. And if you let the AC run in that mode for a while, it'll just suck the moisture right out of the air into RDB. Back to Ned.
That's a very good point there, Tim. By setting it only 1 or 2 degrees colder than the temperature of the room, it automatically will be cycling just the right amount to control things without running too long, doing a freeze up, and so on. So in other words, even though you think you don't have enough controls like the fan speed of your particular window air conditioner, by setting the thermostat the right way, you can regain control, is what I think you're saying. Good piece of information. When it comes to the unusual questions we receive, John, guarantee some of those questions we received by your mailbag have been unusual science questions. We got pretty deep into some subjects that at first seemed to be very far from ham radio. There were people in the beginning, when we started discussing subjects off of ham radio, that objected. Let me drop. People who were very unhappy. There were people who were very unhappy about the fact we were discussing non-ham radio subjects. And then I started thinking, what is a non-ham radio subject? From my point of view, a true ham radio operator, there's a kind of a scientist inside trying to fight to get out. He really is curious about many things. Astronomy, as well as ham radio, radio astronomy, how any of the appliances in the house work, how any of the physical investigations in the field of physics that are going on. It might be the Large Hadron Collider, for instance. So, any of these subjects that are of interest to ham radio operators, I think it's appropriate to talk about. That's an opinion. Not everyone agrees. And if you agree that we're discussing, you feel that we're discussing the wrong subject, that 2-meter radio you've got has got 800 individual channels. You can listen to one of the 799 other channels, if you know what I mean. There are people who want to have control of everything. No, we all want to have control of things. And we're not going to get control of everything. And so if you think you're going to get control of the subjects that we discuss on the TechNet, that's a tough one. But some of those questions you received in the mailbag, do you think of one of the really off subject, pretty far left of center that you didn't quite expect, that turned into be a fun subject to discuss? Maybe you can think of one of those, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Yeah, Dick, you know, you mentioned that, and I got a note on the chat room that when is the discussion going to get back to ham radio? You know, and there are people out there that may not like the pursuit of other elements, but I agree with you. Most ham radio operators, if you look at the magazines they receive and the information they peruse, not all ham radio. They're interested in many subjects, and especially the younger generation. That's where we get some of the real great questions.
There you go, Jack. Go right ahead there, K2EJ, K2IW.
No, in all the years that I've been listening to the TechNet and participating, I mean, if we're going to talk about a subject, I mean, let's do it by category. We generally discuss science. Sometimes we get into other things, but that's pretty rare. But we generally discuss some form of science, physics, mechanics, anything you can think of. Just of interest to anyone that has an interest in why ham radio works. That's science. You know, it's like physics. It's just a particular branch of it. Oh, and by the way, with your air conditioning discussion, because we do a lot of that with the facilities we have, but today's modern central air conditioning units tend to use the type of compressors that are actually operated at a variable speed, and they use sensors in each room. So that way you're basically using as much energy as needed as the demand in a particular area. What I did in my house is I put in a series of mini splits. They're way more efficient. You know, no ducting involved. You know, you're running them freon. And I did the whole thing myself. But one of the things that we do in our transmitter rooms is we have a little computer that figures out the dew point, and we're not really looking at the temperature, we're looking at the humidity. You could, in older systems, you'll find something called a humidistat that would drive it. But the more modern systems are a lot smarter than that. K2RWK2J.
Do we have a dig?
Yeah, thank you for the information, Eric. And Rich recognized. Yep. than the air conditioning equipment you buy nowadays. I think they've got an extremely high, what we call efficiency rating, but I think it's called the EER or something like that rating, and the number greater than 12 is where you're really getting your you're getting your money's worth. In other words, the amount of electricity you consume versus the amount of cooling you get. Do you happen to know what was the EER rating of the system you've installed, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LIW.
No, it's the one at the house. I mean, it uses what they call an inverter, basically. It's a stepper motor that's driving the compressor, and it's a screw. It's a small centrifugal rather than centrifugal. That thing, I think, is rated like 819, something like that. It's just very high end of the scale. And, of course, the rating actually changes depending upon the load that you place on it. But the nice thing about it is that you only need a certain amount of demand in a particular room. That's what it supplies. And if you actually put an ammeter on the darn thing and watch how much current it draws, it's variable. It all depends upon the load that you're asking it to take care of.
The air conditioner compressor and many of the fans and other things that we run that have an electric motor. In the old days, that electric motor had to be something of very constant RPM, close to 1800 RPM, because it was running synchronous to the 60 cycles. Nowadays, modern day machinery with a motor is using a brushless DC motor. By way of the controls of the electronics going to that motor, you can now run that motor almost any speed you want, and it does so efficiently. I can't think of the brand name of the washing machine I just recently bought, but it's got a brushless DC motor in there, and it can run super fast and super slow, and the transmission that used to be in the washing machine, in order to spin the tub fast enough to do a good job of drying, that transmission is no longer there. It's a motor, a brushless DC motor, that's capable of running very high torque at low RPM, and very high torque at high RPM. I'm wondering if brushless DC motors are now being used for the compressor function of modern-day air conditioning equipment. KE2EJ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
K2LIW, K2EJ. Well, interestingly enough, Mitsubishi and Fujitsu kind of pioneered their way at what would today call mini-split. Basically, it's a stepper, brushless DC motor. It's usually three-phase, three-coil, pair of, high amperage MOSFETs that drive them. Not too big. And again, it's not a reciprocating compressor, it's a centrifugal compressor, so that way the variable speed works quite well, and it gives it, the velocity of the liquid, and by the way, today we're pretty much using 410A, which operates at higher pressures, to move the refrigerant through the system, and again, depending upon the load, you spin the compressor at a faster speed to deal with more load, or a slower speed. Calculate through the theory of thermodynamics the actual velocity that's required for any number of given BTUs that you want to remove or move from one place to another. And the nice thing about the mini splits is that a lot of them have these four-way valves in it. You can turn the evaporator into a compressor, so in the winter, if you want heat, you get that. RWK2J. Oh, by the way, the big companies like Carrier and stuff are now beginning to go that way.
NY2HS, what a comment.
If your washing machine, is it a Bosch?
No, it's a much more popular brand than that. All of a sudden, I can't think of the brand name.
Samsung?
Say again?
Samsung, they're big into it.
It's a very popular brand name that I can't think of right now, but a rotary scroll compressor for an air conditioning system, I think it can tolerate a lot of higher and lower speeds than the ordinary piston type, and that combined with a brushless DC motor gives you a hell of a lot more control. And so our ordinary, 1800 RPM type electric motors, fractional horsepower type electric motors, I think they're becoming a bit obsolete by way of brushless DC motors. These brushless DC motors, by way of MOSFETs doing the switching, can do it a hell of a lot more efficiently. On top of that, some of them are doing very high-speed pulse width modulation, by which they are generating just the right right waveform that when you switch from driving coil A, B, and C of the three coils in the stator that's driving this permanent magnet armature, if you generate just the right waveform, you can get a hell of a lot more efficiency and a very cool running motor with an awful lot of torque output.
They also ramp up, so you don't have this huge jaw of current when it starts up.
They also handle the high head pressure better.
Yes, yeah, so they don't run into locked rotor problems of the old-fashioned ones. They don't run into too many BTUs or too few BTUs for this particular weather condition in your house. So it looks like something has been around for a long time. There's still a great deal of improvement that can be added to that. The next person on our list who wanted to make comment on all this was Rich. N2EO, go ahead, Rich. K2IW, the tech man.
Okay, Dick, I have a second question, if that's allowed, after you go through the list. And I just wanted to make a comment. I was one of the people, as you know, that originally objected to non-AM radio subjects. And then I asked a question on astronomy. And I changed my whole opinion. Anything that people want to discuss, I think is A-OK with me.
Yeah, an awful lot of us run into a situation where we say, gee, I will never do so-and-so. I, for instance, used to, the early days of vector network analyzers, made by a good company, Hewlett-Packard, that ordinarily makes very good products. The early vector network analyzers, to me, were very annoying to use, kind of clunky, needed a whole lot of calibrating. I developed a pretty strong dislike of vector network analyzers. I found all kinds of ways of getting around that kind of testing by way of using spectrum analyzers and signal generators and things like that, until all of a sudden the guy I was working with decided to purchase a Rohde & Schwarz vector network analyzer. Boy, did they do a beautiful job. And all of a sudden I fell in love with those things. Another subject I used to strongly disagree with was that when the company called Walmart moves into your town, and the assumption they've got permission from the local building department, zoning board, and whatever, an awful lot of mom-and-pop stores are going to be put out of business because they can't compete with the prices and the volume and whatever that that Walmart is able to produce. And so I used to think that Walmart moving into your town is making more undesirable changes than desirable changes. And to some degree, that's still true because, yeah, people are working at Walmart, but in many cases, they're being paid minimum wage. However, I ran into a problem recently, let me drop it, where I'm a person who just really likes eyeglasses that are large in style. In other words, the so-called aviator style of glasses. And all of the firms I used to deal with, all of a sudden, their frame manufacturer decided to dictate that the aviator style would no longer be sold. The so-called designer style, the tiny little lenses, are all they're going to sell. And I could no longer find a store that would sell me the kind of frame that I like. I walked into Walmart and they had seven of those aviator styles sitting on the shelf ready to roll. And another thing that I insisted on is I don't like plastic lenses. I want glass lenses that don't run into scratching problems so much. And Walmart will sell me whatever frame I want, whatever glass I want inside of it. I don't have to buy plastic, if you know what I mean. So the store that I wasn't so happy with, all of a sudden, I'm not so unhappy with them, even though they still do make a significant change to the lifestyle. And by the way, of all the crazy subjects we've discussed on the TechNet, astronomy, science, physics, sometimes even medicine, so we get pretty far and wide. The ham radio operators are interested in a lot of quasi-technical subjects. Any of those subjects, I think, are appropriate. Let's see, who was the other person who wanted to make a comment? Give me your call letters right now again. K2RAW.
NY2HF.
Go ahead.
Good comment.
Okay, I think it's NUZ, but Dennis first. NY2HF, K2RAW and Technic. Go ahead, Dennis.
Thank you, Dick. On the subject of air conditioning, it's funny that I had a problem this summer and I went to Blackman's gal, to the technical people. What they said was, oh, it had to be the contact. So I went to Blackman's, bought the contact, replaced it, and that wasn't it. Then they said, well, it has to be the capacitor in the air conditioning. And it was not the capacitor. It was actually a relay in the attic that was computer chip driven that was holding the whole air conditioning back. So I just wanted to put, you know, that out to the net that, you know, if you reach out to them and they say, oh, well, it's the contactor, well, probably not. You know, even though that's the most obvious. Back to net.
VZ, comment?
YVZ recognized. Let me go back to Dennis, though, for a second here. Dennis, it looks to me like you did your own, at least I think you did your own troubleshooting, and you're willing to do that troubleshooting. How did you finally recognize the component in the attic that was giving you that grief? Over to you, Dennis, K2LAW.
Okay, thank you, Dick. What happened was they said that possibly it was the 24-volt transformer, and the 24-volt transformer happened to be in the attic, which is where the air handler was. And when I was up there, there was directions for the air handler left there by the person who installed it. And actually, I started to read through it after I tested the 24-volt and saw that it was actually 24-volt, so it wasn't doing anything wrong. But I read through the manual, and the manual said there's a reset. And I pressed the reset, and lo and behold, everything came back on. Back to that.
Yeah, well done, Dennis. We shouldn't be afraid to do our own troubleshooting, in my opinion. There are a couple of places where it's kind of dangerous, but for the most part, an awful lot of the machinery in our house, we really have the ability to maintain it if you've got the right attitude and you do it carefully enough. Don't take any chances by exposing yourself to high voltage and hot equipment and so on. So, and there are times where doing your own troubleshooting can save you quite a big piece of change. Now, the person who was signing in, I'm hearing the call letters in three different manners. I thought I heard NUZ, YVZ. You know who you are. Please give me your full set of calls and your names, ma'am. K2RIW and the TechNet.
It's Whiskey Alpha 2, Yankee Bravo Zulu.
Okay, Yankee Bravo Zulu. Please start off with your name and then can proceed with your comments. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Yeah, this is Peg. And Dick, I was just going to follow up with a quick comment about when you were discussing Walmart. Let me go. There's a